Welcome to this LexisNexis webinar on the latest in agricultural law. My name is Seaman Anwar and I'm an associate in the agricultural litigation team at Mitchell Moores. I'm joined by Raj Kaur, a senior associate also in the contentious agriculture team at Mitchell Moores. As you will see from the slide on your screen, in the first half of the webinar, we'll be discussing the Agriculture Act 2020 and the changes brought about by that act. In the second half, we will then go on to discuss the Environment Bill. Towards the end of the webinar, there will also be a quiz so you can all test what you've learned from today's webinar. So let's get going and move on to the next slide. So as I said, the first topic we will cover in this webinar is the Agriculture Act 2020, which has now been in force for almost a year. As we set out on the next slide, the areas we will be covering are the purpose of the Act, and we will be providing an overview of the Act. Then we will look at changes to the financial assistance schemes. There will then be a brief look at Schedule 3 of the Act, which concerns landlord and tenant matters. And then we'll finally go on to looking at the position in Wales. I should add that today's webinar is intended to provide only a very quick whistle-stop tour through the Act. The Act marks a significant milestone in agricultural policy and has some far-reaching consequences for the agricultural industry. Anyone who acts or is intending to act for clients in this industry is well advised to consider the Act and its implications in much more detail. So moving on to the next slide and the purpose of the Act. So the Act was enacted on the 11th of November 2020. It marks the biggest change in agricultural policy in half a century, and it has been heralded by DEFRA as providing a move away from the inefficient and overly bureaucratic policy of the EU. Amongst other matters, the Act was designed to move away from the Common Agricultural Policy, or CAP, as many of you might know it, which has been in place for many years now. The idea is that the UK will now move towards more of a British agricultural policy.
So, Seema, what are the underlying objectives of the legislation?
Well, so the underlying objectives of the legislation are broadly to drive competitiveness, to increase productivity and the use of technology, and to generate fairer returns. The Act is said to provide powers needed to incentivize farmers to make the right environmental choices. It also places focus upon this notion of public money for public goods, which is something you might have all heard of recently. So let's move on now to the next slide and get an overview of the Act itself. So at the moment, what we largely have from the Act is a framework which has been moulded by the parliamentary process. The devil will inevitably be in the detail, and much of that is still to be formalised in further statutory instruments.
Seema, what does the Act cover at present?
Well, I won't go through all of it and all of the ins and outs and the finer details of each provision of the Act, as that is far beyond the scope of this webinar. However, the broad structure is as follows. Part one deals with financial assistance. Chapter one deals with the new financial assistance schemes. In particular, it gives the Secretary of State new powers to provide financial assistance to those managing land or water and delivering public benefits, such as in respect of air and water quality, public access and productivity. The second chapter then deals with changes to the basic payment scheme, which is the current subsidy scheme in place, which provides direct payments to farmers. Chapter three then deals with other financial support after Brexit. This includes in relation to things like the rural development schemes. We will talk more about the changes to financial assistance schemes later on in this webinar. But for now, let's move on to the next slide, which looks at part two of the Act. Part two of the Act then deals with food and agricultural markets. Chapter one deals with food security and places a duty on the government to report to Parliament on UK food security. The first report will be due towards the end of 2021 and then every 3 years thereafter. Chapter two then deals with intervention in agricultural markets where there are exceptional market conditions. So if you move on to the next slide, we can have a look at parts three and four. Very briefly then, part three of the Act deals with transparency and fairness in the agri-food supply chain. Part three includes wide powers extending to Wales and Northern Ireland to collect and share data from those in or connected with an agri-supply chain, to essentially collate information connected with their activities in that chain. Household consumers are in fact excluded from that requirement. There are also fair dealing obligations for business purchases in order to promote fair contractual dealing. The data collected and shared under these provisions is intended to help farmers and producers increase productivity, to help producers to manage risks and market volatility, and to support animal and plant health and traceability. The objectives are clearly sound, but there is a lot of work still to be done to achieve them. Part four then deals with certain other matters relating to farming and the countryside. Of particular note for our purposes is section 36, which notes that Schedule 3 of the Act makes provisions in respect of agricultural tenancies. And we will discuss those later on in this webinar. So if we move on to the next slide, we can have a look at parts 5 and 6. So moving through the Act a bit further, you have part 5. That deals with various matters concerning agricultural products. This includes giving the Secretary of State power to make regulations concerning, for example, technical definitions and sales descriptions, classification criteria, labelling, packaging, and those kinds of things. Part 6 of the Act then includes powers to make regulations for securing compliance with the World Trade Organization's Agreement on Agriculture. You then have Part 7 and 8, which also deal with other general matters and also the position in Wales and Northern Ireland. So that is just a very, very quick run through of the structure of the Act. As I said at the beginning, anyone advising clients on the Act should take time to consider the provisions in much more detail. Let's now move on to the next slide and the next topic in respect of the Act, which is financial assistance.
Seema, you mentioned that the Act introduced powers to make changes to the financial assistance schemes currently available. So what are the planned changes?
Well, this is a key part of the Agriculture Act and of matters arising out of the Act. And those advising clients on this really need to get to grips with the details. As explained previously, the Act gives powers to the Secretary of State to set up new schemes and give financial assistance for a whole list of purposes. It introduces powers to change the current basic payment scheme. The government has now set out its plans or roadmap for changes to the financial assistance schemes, which broadly involves as follows. So it is intended that direct payments and existing agri-environment schemes shall be phased out, which process has started this year. The last direct payments are intended to be made in 2027. There is also to be the introduction of a new scheme known as the Environmental Land Management Scheme, or ELMS, as it is more commonly known for short. Full rollout of ELMS is planned to be from 2024. There is therefore intended to be a 7-year transition period through which direct payments will be phased out and ELMS will be introduced. As part of the plans, the government is introducing this concept of delinking payments and lump sums with a view to phasing out basic payment scheme entirely. In 2022, the intention is that farmers will have the opportunity to receive a one-off lump sum payment in lieu of the payments they would otherwise receive under the remainder of the basic payment scheme until 2027. Lump sums shall only be available in circumstances where the farmer intends to either leave the industry entirely or to retire. The intention behind this offering is to help older farmers or others wanting to leave the industry, but who cannot do that due to lack of finance, so that they can actually leave the sector. But that is not the only motivator behind this. The idea is also then to make room for new entrants and existing farmers who wish to expand their offerings. For those who have not taken the lump sum in 2024, the plan is for delinked payments to be introduced. This concept of delinking of payments essentially means that basic payment scheme recipients will not have to continue farming or hold basic payment scheme entitlements to receive the subsidies. It will not be an opt-in or opt-out system, and it will happen for all farmers. By 2027, it is intended that direct payments will cease completely. So let's now move on to the next slide and have a look at the new ELMS scheme. As I mentioned earlier, the financial assistance scheme to be introduced is the ELMS. There are three components of the ELMS offering, namely the Sustainable Farming Incentive, the Local Nature Recovery Scheme, and the Landscape Recovery Scheme. The national pilots for ELMS are intended to run between 2021 and 2024, and I understand that they were supposed to have gone live in October this year. The full rollout, as mentioned previously, is planned for 2024. These are the timelines announced to date, but it waits to be seen whether the government can keep to these timescales, noting the intervening challenges the country has faced since, such as COVID, Brexit, etc. ELMS is intended to reward farmers for meeting environmental and other objectives. ELMS will not, however, be a direct substitute for income that will be lost through direct payments, and therefore there will be a number of business decisions to be made for farmers going forwards.
Is the country stewardship scheme also being scrapped?
Well, the countryside stewardship scheme will be continuing until 2024. The schemes are, however, said to have been improved and simplified. So if we move on to the next slide now and have a look at landlord and tenant matters. So leaving the matter of financial assistance there, I will now talk you through the headline changes affecting agricultural tenancies. I will start first with the changes affecting landlord and tenants under tenancy agreements governed by the Agricultural Holdings Act 1986, i.e. AHA tenancies. You'll see on the slide there's a whole long list of matters, so we'll just run through those one by one. So as you will see, the first topic on the slide is rent review. The Agriculture Act makes changes to the 1986 Act so that third-party determination of rental disputes stand on the same footing as determination by arbitration. Due to the way the various bits of legislation were drafted, the appointment of a third party to determine the rent under an AHA tenancy had to be done at least 12 months before the review date, whereas an arbitrator only had to be appointed by the review date and not 12 months before. The Agriculture Act addresses this so that the appointment of the third party only now needs to be before the review date, i.e. it brings it in line with the position for arbitrators. That change came into force on the 11th of January 2021. On the topic of rent review, Schedule 2 of the 1986 Act sets out provisions to be followed when determining the rent. The Agriculture Act also inserts a new provision into paragraph 3 of that schedule regarding improvements on the holding financed by the landlord. Anyone who deals with rent review under AHA tenancies should make sure that they are alive to this change. Moving on to the next bullet point and the appointment of arbitrators under the 1986 Act. The list of appointing bodies for appointing arbitrators under the 1986 Act has long consisted of only the RICS. Under the Agriculture Act 2020, the list of appointing bodies has been widened to include the Agricultural Law Association, or the ALA, as you might know it, and the CAAV, which now sit alongside the RICS. So essentially the list is widened. So that came into force on the 11th of January, 2021. A further change brought about by the 2020 Act relates to landlords' consents. The Agriculture Act 2020 gives DEFRA and the Welsh Minister power to bring in regulations which allow a tenant, in circumstances where a request for consent was refused by the landlord, to refer that to arbitration. The parties may agree alternatively to a third-party determination if they want to. The tenant's request, however, must relate to certain matters. They must relate to a variation to the tenancy or a request for consent to enable the tenant to request or apply for financial assistance or to comply with a statutory duty. The whole purpose behind this change is to loosen the restrictions on tenants which currently exist in tenancy agreements so they have a better chance of being able to access funds in the new world of public money for public goods. It is also with an eye to varying terms which prevent tenants undertaking activities to meet regulatory requirements, specifically environmental obligations. Confusingly, we will actually see separate regulations for England and for Wales in this regard. England have now in fact brought in some regulations, being the Agricultural Holdings Request for Landlord's Consent or Variation of Terms and the Suitability Test England Regulations 2021. Which is a very catchy name, and that came into force on the 21st of June, 2021. There are then changes to Case A notices to quit. The date upon which Case A notice to quit relevant to lettings of small holdings The date upon which they could be served was originally the date a tenant reached 65 and with other conditions. The Act essentially changes this so that the age is now the tenant's pensionable age. So finally and significantly, the Act also brings about changes to the eligibility and suitability tests for succession to an AHA tenancy. We'll run through those now very briefly. So firstly, the long-standing minimum age for retirement for a retirement notice of 65 has, with effect from the 11th of January 2021, been abolished in both England and Wales. With regard to the commercial unit test and the whole of Schedule 6 of the 1986 Act, that is to be abolished. This has not yet happened. This provision will not come into effect until a date appointed in regulations brought in by the Secretary of State. These changes will take effect in both England and Wales. They will cover all successions which have not been decided prior to the relevant date. The objective is to improve productivity, allowing farmers operating on a larger scale to succeed if all other conditions are met. It is also intended to assist moving a tenancy down a generation if the relevant requirements are met. Before the regulations come in, applicants will still have to show they are not the occupier of a commercial unit. While Schedule 6 is being removed, provision will be added to the 1986 Act so that attendance at a full-time course at university or college can still count towards the period required for the principal source of livelihood test. However, 3 years attendance is the maximum period which will be taken into account. The new regulations, which will abolish the commercial unit test in England and Wales, will also set out a new suitability and business competency test. Those have now been enacted in England. Those regulations have the very catchy name of the Agriculture Act 2020, Commencement Number 1 and Transitional Provision, England Regulations 2021. They confirm that from the 1st of September 2024, the commercial unit test will no longer form part of the eligibility test, and that succession applicants will only need to satisfy the close relationship test and the principal source of livelihood test. From the 1st of September 2024, they will also have to satisfy a revised suitability test. These changes will apply to applications where the date of death or retirement notice is on or after 1st of September 2024. Existing rules will continue to apply before then. In terms of the business competency test or the new suitability test, there is a strong focus on business management skills. For the first time, there is also a focus on care for the environment.
What about farm business tenancies? Does the Act change anything in relation to those tenancies and the Agricultural Tenancies Act 1995?
Well, let's move on to the next slide and have a look at this. So as stated on the slide, there are only very limited changes made to the 1995 Act and FBTs. The only change relates to the bodies which can appoint arbitrators under the 1995 Act. Again, these bodies have been widened to include the ALA and the CAAV. Moving on then to the final slide and looking at the position in Wales. As it says on the slide, the Agriculture Act provides little detail on how the issues covered would develop in Wales. Powers were instead granted to the Welsh Government to implement its own post-Brexit agricultural support scheme or schemes and to manage the transition away from the basic payment scheme.
So what's the current position?
Well, following a consultation which ended in March 2021, the Welsh Government has announced it will publish an agriculture bill in autumn 2021. The Welsh Government has also committed to paying BPS payments in full in 2021/2022 until the bill comes into effect. The Welsh Government is essentially proposing to support farmers financially on a principle of sustainable land management and payment of the production of public goods. With regard to landlord and tenant matters, all but one of the landlord and tenant changes proposed by the Agriculture Act 2020 apply to Wales and came into force on the 11th of January 2021, in line with the English reforms discussed earlier in this webinar. There was one proposal which was not accepted by the Welsh Government, namely the proposal to enable 1986 Act tenants to refer to arbitration or third-party determination requests for landlord's consent to activities that are restricted under the terms of the tenancy or requests for a variation of the tenancy for the purposes of enabling the tenant to access financial assistance or to comply with a statutory duty. This is intended to be dealt with under the Agriculture Wales Bill. So that brings us to the end of my whistle-stop tour through the Agriculture Act. As I said at the beginning, this webinar provides only a high-level overview of the key aspects of the Act. A more detailed look at the Act is always recommended. The changes brought about by the Act will no doubt play a big part in business planning decisions for those in the industry and impact on the relationship of landlords and tenants. It waits to be seen how the changes will, however, play out in practice. I'll now pass on to Raj, who will now talk you through the Environment Bill.
Thank you, Seema. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm now going to move on and start by talking about the Environment Bill, which is a key piece of draft legislation that has featured heavily in the news recently. I'm then going to move on to briefly summarise some of the key cases that have been heard since the passing of the Electronic Communications Code in 2017. So starting with my first slide, the Environment Bill was first proposed back in 2018. Due to the coronavirus pandemic and other factors, the bill has unfortunately been significantly delayed. New emphasis, however, has been put on it recently, which has meant that it is back before Parliament and is currently in the final stages of consideration by Parliament. So why was the bill proposed in the first place? Well, the bill was primarily introduced to allay concerns about the potential loss of established environmental principles following the UK leaving the EU. The bill is part of the government's plan to facilitate its longer-term objective, which I quote, is for this to be the first generation to leave the environment in a better state than that in which we inherited it, and also its manifesto pledge to protect and restore our natural environment after leaving the EU. Moving on to the next slide then, we can have a look at the ways in which the bill actually proposes to achieve the goals I've just mentioned. In a nutshell, it proposes to do this in two main ways. The first is that it provides a new domestic framework for environmental governance, which will be known as the Office for Environmental Protection. And the second is that it sets out provisions relating to specific environmental policy areas, which include waste, air quality, water, nature, biodiversity, and conservation covenants.
That sounds like a very broad set of areas, Raj. How long is the bill?
Well, the bill is ever evolving. It's very lengthy and spans to some 300 pages at the moment. It would take me several hours to go through the bill in detail, so I'm just going to give you a very bird's eye view today of what is currently proposed in it. So if we turn on to my next slide, the bill specifies a series of environmental principles and requires the publication of a policy statement on how these principles are going to be applied by ministers during policymaking. Importantly, as I said earlier, the bill establishes a new public body, which will be called the Office for Environmental Protection, or OEP for short. That office is going to have the power to investigate the actions of the government and local authorities, to take enforcement action, and to provide guidance and recommendations to them. Whilst the remainder of the bill sets out targets in certain key areas, the OEP will be responsible for monitoring whether or not those targets are actually being met. Importantly, the OEP is not going to replace the Environment Agency. You've got to remember that the Environment Agency regulates private actions. This OEP that will be set up is going to govern actions by public authorities and the government. The government has committed to giving the OEP an estimated 5-year budget will be set up and set aside within each spending review period.
OEP will clearly have a tough job ensuring that the new roles are enforced. Do you think it will have enough powers to do this job effectively in practice?
That's a fair question, Seema. And if we turn to my next slide, we can see it's actually been quite widely debated. So we can see that the bill establishes a new court procedure for writing breaches for environmental law by a public authority, and that's going to be called the environmental review process. The default outcome in an environmental review where there has been a breach is that there will be the issuing of a statement of non-compliance. Crucially, though, this statement does not actually affect the validity of the unlawful conduct that has taken place. And a lot of people have criticised that because it reverses the existing position, which is that an unlawful act by a public authority is presumed to be void, although there is some judicial discretion to validate that act after the event. So on that basis, it undermines the principle of legality which we currently have and replaces it with a presumption that an unlawful act by a public authority is still valid. In addition, whilst the decision notice issued by the OEP will specify what the failure by the local authority is and the steps it considers the local authority needs to take, the decision notice is not actually binding upon the local authority, which some have said is a real issue. They have said, you know, that this significantly reduces the OEP's ability to police environmental breaches in practice. Others have also argued that the OEP is impartial rather than properly independent from the government. It's the Secretary of State that can issue guidance to the OEP on its enforcement policy and on its environmental on its enforcement functions. And the OEP must have regard to this guidance. Also, that it's the Secretary of State who is closely involved in appointing and paying the members of the OEP. So many have argued that these actually limit the extent of the OEP's independence in practice. Turning to the next slide then, we're going to move away from the OEP to the other parts of the bill. Those parts essentially give the Secretary of State the power to set long-term targets in relation to environmental matters. The bill specifically states that a long-term target must be set for certain priority areas, such as water, air quality, and biodiversity. It's part four of the bill that covers air quality. The bill introduces a legally binding duty on the government to bring forward at least 2 air quality targets by October 2022. It changes the way that local air quality management frameworks are managed and gives local authorities increased powers in relation to smoke control areas. It also includes a provision to allow the recall of motor vehicles purely for environment reasons. Moving on then to part five of the bill, that covers water resource management. The provisions in that part of the bill include the introduction of joint regional frameworks for long-term water resource management. Water companies will also be obliged to develop plans relating to drainage and sewage management. And as I said earlier, the bill is ever evolving. One of the most recent amendments proposed to the bill was for it to place a legal duty on water companies to take all reasonable steps to ensure untreated sewage is not discharged from storm overflows. It's something that's caused a real stir in the national news recently, and it will remain to be seen whether this proposal actually makes it into the final bill. Moving on then to the next slide, the bill also introduces what is called a biodiversity net gain requirement. And there's been a lot of commentary about what this will mean for future projects. So let's start by understanding what biodiversity actually is. Biodiversity is a reference to the different species of life located in one area. When referring to life, we are talking about everything, including plants, animals, fungi, and even bacteria that make up our natural world. Each form of life is part of an intricate ecosystem in a careful balance which supports the Earth. So what is biodiversity net gain then? The problem being addressed by this part of the bill is that the Earth has been put under significant strain because humans are consuming too much of the Earth's resources. There is therefore a very real risk that biodiversity is eventually going to be lost. At part six of the bill, it introduces the new biodiversity net gain requirement of 10% for developers that are putting plans through the planning system. It will be mandatory for developers to show that the requirement will be met and maintained for 30 years. So essentially, biodiversity net gain is an approach to development or land management that leaves nature in a measurably better state than it was beforehand. Planning applicants will have to avoid harm and mitigate or financially compensate for any losses that are caused. DEFRA has developed a biodiversity metric to measure whether or not the net gain requirement has been met. Local authorities will now need to conserve and enhance rather than just conserve biodiversity in England.
How will biodiversity be policed in practice?
To achieve biodiversity net gain, proposals must follow what we call the mitigation hierarchy. It's based on a series of steps that will need to be taken throughout a project's life cycle to limit any negative impact on biodiversity. These steps will need to be clearly specified in the planning conditions that attach to each project. And then moving on to the final part of the Act that we're going to look at, we're going to move on to conservation covenants, which are again another very widely reported part of the Bill. So part 7 of the Bill creates voluntary, legally binding conservation covenants between landowners and responsible bodies. Broadly speaking, a conservation covenant is a private, voluntary agreement made between a landowner and a conservation body to carry out conservation measures in relation to a particular piece of land. Importantly, though, once they've been entered into, conservation covenants will bind future purchasers of the land. The motivation behind the creation of these conservation covenants was the Law Commission report of June 2014, which highlighted that under the existing English property law, covenants will only bind future landowners if there is a benefit to neighbouring land, rather than just because they benefit the public in general. So even where they are binding, it's only a restrictive covenant rather than a covenant to take some positive action, which would actually bind future owners of the land. Hence, it was felt that a new type of covenant was needed, which would run with the land purely because it benefits the public good, and which imposes some sort of positive burden to do something in relation to the land, rather than just a negative one not to do something on the land. So looking at what the conservation covenants are going to look like, to qualify as a conservation covenant, it must firstly relate to land which the owner has a freehold interest in or has a leasehold interest in for more than 7 years, and it must either require the owner to do or not to do something on the land, or to allow or place an obligation on a responsible body to do something on the land. And finally, it must have some sort of conservation purpose, i.e. protection, restoration, and enhancement of the environment.
Okay, so when might a conservation covenant actually be used in practice?
Good question. So one example would be where a testator wants to ensure that certain land that he owns is going to be put to some conservation purpose after he or she dies. One option would be to donate that land to a charitable body under the will to ensure that conservation objectives are carried out. However, the other option now, as a result of this new legislation, would be to bequeath the land under the testator's will to their family, but to make it subject to a conservation covenant. That way, the land can be passed down to the next generation in the family, but the conservation purpose must carry on. Similarly, a conservation covenant between a landowner and a wildlife charity could allow the charity to secure the maintenance of a habitat for payment or otherwise, without actually having to buy the land, which the landowner may be unwilling to sell in any case. And also, they could be a way for developers to show that they have actually addressed the biodiversity net gain requirements that we talked about earlier through the use of conservation covenants in their plans. Moving on then to the next slide and turning away from the Environment Bill, I'm now going to move on to talk about the Electronic Communications Code 2017. So let's start by looking at what the code actually is. The code gives telecommunications operators statutory rights for the creation and operation of their communications networks. The legislation has obviously become even more crucial during the pandemic when so many of us were relying upon those communications networks to keep in touch with each other and to work from home. The rights under the code can be granted only to operators. An operator is an electronic communications operator who has obtained a direction from Ofcom that the code actually applies to them. So not everybody is going to be eligible. So what rights are specifically granted under the code? Well, we refer to them as code rights. And code rights are rights in relation to electronic communications apparatus to do a number of different things, such as to install the apparatus on the land, to inspect and maintain, alter, repair or upgrade the apparatus, to carry out works on the land in connection with the installation of the apparatus, to carry out works on the land for or in connection with the maintenance of the apparatus, and also to do various other things such as to lop or cut back vegetation that may or will interfere with the apparatus.
How does a person acquire code rights in practice?
So the code rights can be obtained in two main ways. Firstly, by way of written agreement with the relevant occupier of the land. And secondly, by an agreement imposed by court order. So landowners can have agreements forced upon them by the court. Now, what we're going to look at now is that there have been several telecoms cases since the new code was introduced, and which have required the court to deal with the interpretation of certain parts of the code. If we turn to the final slide, I'm just going to touch on a few of the key cases recently. So let's start with a case called Cornerstone Telecommunications Infrastructure, or CTIL for short, versus Ashlock Limited and AP Wireless 2 UK Limited. This case concerned paragraph 9 of the code, which confirms that a code right in respect of land may only be conferred on an operator by agreement between the occupier of the land and the operator. The case concerned a rooftop site, and AP Wireless argued that CTIL could not use part 4 of the code as it was already in occupation as the operator and could not enter into a contract with itself. At first instance, it was decided that the government's policy on the code was that it should not be retrospective, thus benefiting the operator. However, when the case was heard by the Court of Appeal, it rejected those findings because it felt that they would give the operator a unilateral weapon against the landowner. So that case has now clarified that it is only the occupier who can confer code rights, except for in certain limited exceptions under the code. Another complex issue that was considered in this case was what happens when there is a conflict between the old code rights and the provisions of the Landlord and Tenant Act 1954. The transitional provisions of the code aim to clarify the circumstances in which the new laws will apply. The basic principle is that all subsisting agreements under the old code take effect as new code agreements, but certain qualifications apply where the 1954 Act still applies. The tribunal confirmed that a telecommunications lease excluded from security of tenure will be renewed in accordance with the code, whereas the 1954 Act will apply to a renewal of a similar lease whose primary purpose was not to grant code rights. Where the parties have not contracted out of security of tenure, then a telecoms lease must be renewed in accordance with the 1954 Act, but will thereafter be regarded as a code agreement. It was felt that this was only fair because a landlord under the 1954 Act regime could oppose the grant of a new lease where it intended to occupy the site for purposes of its own business. No such opportunity exists under the code, and to deprive a landlord of such a right in the context of an ongoing lease would be a significant and unjustified erosion of their legal rights. Moving on to the next case then, this is called Cornerstone versus University of the Arts London. Following the grant of interim code rights, which the landowner challenged unsuccessfully in the Court of Appeal last year, this case concerned the operator's application for code rights under paragraph 20 to install and operate apparatus on the rooftop of the London College of Communications. The landowner opposed the imposition of code rights as it had agreed to sell the London College of Communications to a developer with vacant possession prior to its demolition. The landowner argued that the imposition of the code agreement would prevent it from complying with its obligations to the developer. Accordingly, the landowner would suffer prejudice, which could not be compensated by money, and that prejudice would not be outweighed by the public benefit of imposing the code rights. Contrary to the landowner's arguments, the tribunal found that it could only consider the public benefit of the rights being imposed as against no rights being imposed, and could not assume that interim rights could be granted or the apparatus could be installed elsewhere. Furthermore, the tribunal found that it should not weigh up the net public benefit of the imposition of code rights, in that the code rights might have a negative effect on the redevelopment, which it was argued would also be in the public benefit. In the end, the tribunal found that public benefit would generally outweigh a landowner's inconvenience, annoyance, and readily calculable losses. But in the present case, it did find that there was more at stake. The case crossed the boundary between prejudice that has to be suffered by a landowner for the public good and the prejudice that is too much to ask, and accordingly declined to impose the code rights in this case. Although the decision in this case went in the landowner's favour, the tribunal made it very clear that the landowner will generally face an uphill battle to show that prejudice it suffers outweighs the public benefit in general. And it's arguable now that since the pandemic, that will be strengthened even further. So the final case we'll look at is called Cornerstone versus London and Quadrant Houses Trust. It touched on an issue which has become a bit of a bugbear, which is how rents are calculated under the code. The tribunal examined in some detail the additional costs and benefits that arise as a result of entering into an agreement to provide a telecommunications site. It identified that while the site value in this case was worth only a mere £50, it would not be right to ignore the benefit to the operator of certain services carried out by the owner, nor the burden to the owner of hosting a telecommunications installation on his property. In this case, the tribunal valued the benefit to the operator of the owner's responsibility for maintenance and insurance at £1,500. It also valued the administrative cost to the owner of managing access by the operator's workmen at £1,000. Further value was attributed to the cost to the owner of keeping track of which operators were using the site under the sharing provisions contained in the license agreement. The result was that whilst the site had a nominal value of £50, the annual rental value was 100 times as much at £5,000 per annum. So as you can see, since the passing of the new code in 2017, the tribunal has had to consider some quite complex issues relating to the interpretation of the code. And there are still other areas which are causing concern and leading to disputes. It will be interesting to see how the interpretation of certain areas of the code further develops in the coming years. So that's all from me and Seema today. We hope you found this webinar provides a good overview of many of the changes that are happening at the moment in the world of agricultural law. Thank you for joining us.